Welcome to the Freedom Report, broadcasting from Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome to the Freedom Report. I'm your host, Austin Peterson. Who's Austin Peterson?
Liberty champion Austin Peterson, this Justin Bieber lookalike, and a powerful advocate for liberty.
Who's Austin Peterson? I'm an American. I love life, liberty, and family, but I'm not a conservative. I'm a hardcore libertarian. What am I doing here? I'm trying to restore the republic. The Libertarian Republic is a website aimed at furthering the ideas of economic freedom and personal liberty. I don't really care about parties. All I care about are ideas. And the one idea I care the most about? Freedom! That's right, pure freedom on the Freedom Report podcast.
Hello and welcome back to the Freedom Report, ladies and gentlemen. I have a very special guest today. He is Stephen Horwitz. He's the Charles A. Dana Professor of Economics and Department Chair at St. Lawrence University in Canton, New York. He's also an affiliated senior scholar at the Mercatus Center in Arlington, Virginia, and a senior fellow at the Fraser Institute in Vancouver, British Columbia. Horwitz completed his MA and PhD in economics at George Mason and received his AB in economics and philosophy from the University of Michigan. He blogs at The Coordination Problem and Bleeding Heart Libertarians. He was also awarded the Hayek Prize in 2010 by the Fund for the Study of Spontaneous Order for his work on the economics of the family, among other contributions. Steve, welcome to the show.
Hey, Austin. Good to be here.
Steve, it's really great to talk to you. You and I have been friends for quite a long time. For those that don't know, Steve Horwitz used to appear on the show that I produced at Fox called Freedom Watch with Judge Napolitano. And Steve and I share a lot of things in common. We don't always agree on everything, but I think that Professor Horwitz represents very much the sort of the future of Austrian economics. And since we're going to be talking about the future of Austrian economics, that seems to be very much intertwined with the liberty movement. And there was a big newspaper article, the front page of the New York Times yesterday, that came out called Rand Paul's Mixed Inheritance. Now, Professor has some very strong views on this topic because it involves Rand Paul, the liberty movement, the issues of racism, sexism, homophobia, bigotry, and it basically caused an enormous stir online. So I'd like to read Professor Horwitz's statement from Facebook yesterday that got everybody talking, and then we're just going to go a little bit back and forth. So Steve writes on Facebook, what we need right now is Rothbard's vision of a free society as sketched in for a new liberty. But we need it defended better, more carefully, more richly, more empirically, more humanely, more progressively, more tolerantly, with better scholarship. And we have to do it in a way that's immune to the charge that libertarians don't care about making the world a better place, especially for the least well-off and those historically victimized by the color of their skin, their gender, their sexual orientation, or anything else that's irrelevant to their moral status as human actors. Steve says that the writings of the paleo-libertarians will continue to stain that project unless and until the rest of the libertarian movement stops trying to apologize for them, saying things like, you don't understand the context, or it was a long time ago, or, quote, Ron's from a different generation, or kicking down the can down the road because Ron Paul might win. He talks about the circular firing squad, or just people saying that this is about media bias. You know, this is the liberal media trying to destroy a libertarian candidate. And for the listeners who aren't familiar, Ron Paul got in trouble because a newsletter surfaced from about 20 years ago that helped to sink Dr. Paul's campaign, containing some very bigoted statements about minorities. Now, Steve goes on to say that it's time to face our ugly past head on and to explicitly reject it. And it's the past of every libertarian. It doesn't matter if you weren't there or weren't alive or think it's stupid. If you call yourself a libertarian, and especially if you support Ron Paul, it's part of your past if you like it or not. That's how life works sometimes. We can't make Ron Paul name the authors or make the authors step forward, either of which would help immensely. We can, however, take pains to make clear that some of Ron Paul's past and current associations are rejected by libertarians who understand the liberal in libertarian and whose vision of a free society is one that is so clearly in conflict with racism, homophobia, anti-Semitism, and all the rest that people like Stormfront would never even consider sending us a donation, and we would recoil at being photographed with them. Now, Steve, I'll just give you a quick little background on this personally. I actually do have a personal investment in this as well, because I remember being in New York City in 2008, and I had built a crack team of libertarian political strategists, and we were really kicking butt. And then all of a sudden, the newsletters dropped, and I had never even heard of them, Steve. And do you know what happened? Half of my team deserted. I mean, I took personal offense at whoever wrote these newsletters and left Ron out to dry, one, but also destroyed the political structure that we had that was doing so well. So I didn't take this just as some, slight against Ron Paul. I took this personally, Steve, because it actually destroyed the work that I had been doing. So I actually sympathize with you, Steve. So what do you think is the real problem here?
The real problem?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a couple things. You know, I mean, that piece that you read is from a blog post from a few years ago, obviously from the 2012 campaign. I think that these are sort of chickens coming home to roost, right? I mean, I think Ron Paul and the people around him 20 years ago thought strategy, and I don't mean just as a strategy. I think they thought it was the right thing to do to sort of open the door to a very broad, what I would call anti-left movement that included both libertarians, but part of the paleo-libertarian idea was to get people critical of culture and really growing, tolerant, permissive culture. So that included people on the right with bigoted views. But it also, it opened up the door, I think, to the nationalists, to all kinds of people who were hearing in what people like Ron Paul were saying and the other messages coming from people like Lou Rockwell and Murray Rothbard at the time, these sort of, I wouldn't even call them coded, these very explicit kinds of signals that you can find sympathy with us, that the things we believe, we think the government is causing all these problems, and for people who had particular views on race or homosexuality or whatever, oftentimes they heard in that what they wanted to hear and what was being signaled, which was the door's open for you to come be part of what we're doing.
Right. Now, my first reaction when those newsletters dropped was, to believe Ron Paul and to defend him, because I got very defensive. I thought that it was the liberal media trying to sort of back him into a corner and to paint him as a racist. His opponents didn't want him to win. But then, Steve, one night I'm in New York City and I sit down for dinner, and all of a sudden I find myself sitting across from someone who is a Nazi. And I'm not talking about idiot skinhead. I'm talking about someone who is a mature, seemingly progressive, strong Catholic Jew hater. I couldn't believe it. I was blown away. And he had all of the conspiracy theories. He was talking about the Federal Reserve, Jew-owned bank, the banking system. It was all the conspiracy theories. But this was not someone that you could just sit down and take lightly, Steve. This was someone who called himself a libertarian and who openly espoused the anti-Semitic ideas that I thought were destroyed at the end of World War II.
Yeah, it's out there, right? I mean, and again, I think that's why the New York Times piece is so interesting from yesterday, because it's not that it's untrue; it's a distorted picture of libertarianism, and in some sense inaccurate about its history. But it's not wrong about the fact that people like the guy you're talking about, or the kinds of people the article's talking about, are part of the movement. It's just true, and it's true because those folks were welcomed in by the strategy from 20 plus years ago, and unfortunately, there's two things going on. I mean, one of the things you and I both agree on and love to do is poke fun at the conspiracy theorists, right? And they don't even have to be racist or anti-Semites. I mean, there's a million conspiracy theories out there that whatever. And I think that's all part of this too. But what it comes down to, in some sense, is that I think what the paleo movement did in some ways is establish a kind of, I like to call it, libertarian contrarianism. Mm-hmm. This sense among many libertarians that if lots of people believe it, it must be wrong.
Right.
Right. So that fuels the conspiracy theories. That fuels the sort of skepticism about science and all this kind of stuff. It fuels the pride in being politically incorrect.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
And I think that's right. All of these things are like, oh, well, being politically correct, that's what everyone else does. That's liberal nonsense or whatever. And so we have to be proud about being different. It's a really bad notion of individuality. That means one always has to be.
Well,
thought that libertarians were the defenders of reason and skepticism, which sometimes means everyone else got it right.
Yeah, I know. Well, Murray Rothbard talked about these people. He called them Luftmenschen, and I actually have updated. I call them hipstertarians. These are people who, to me, are looking for an excuse, a cover for their antisocial behavior. And what I think, Rothbard described them. These are people who don't want the ideas to be mainstream, because if they did, then they want to own something that the rest of the people can't have, because they are so antisocial, and they so dislike other people that they like to use the word anarchist as an excuse to sort of cover for their personality disorders. And I say, I call them hipstertarians, because it's like, I want to be libertarian before it was cool. And if everybody likes it, then it's not cool anymore. So if these ideas become mainstream, and I honestly, there was a lot more hatred directed towards the Reason magazine piece about the New York Times piece, because it was talking about Rand Paul mainstreaming libertarianism on the way to the White House. And they're like, he'd have to be a libertarian first. I'm like, Rand Paul is doing more for the libertarian movement than any libertarian has done in the last 20 years. That's my opinion.
That's maybe stated more strongly than I would, but I think your earlier point is right on. I mean, the way it's like libertarianism has become some people's favorite band that they don't want to tell anyone else about, right?
Right.
It's that same hipster attitude.
Right.
And it can't, that's not a winning strategy, right? A winning and I think the other thing we have to realize as libertarians, and I don't, this is the harder part for me in some ways, having been around for a while, is that as we win, the ideas are going to get watered down from their purest, whatever.
Right.
But I think it's really important for people like me in particular, who work in, sort of directly in the field of ideas, to keep holding up the banner of, I hate the word purity, but to hold up the sort of hardcore radical vision. But we just simply have to recognize, to use an Austrian economics phrase, that the structure of production of political change is such that for change to happen, you have to translate those ideas into forms that other people can get behind. And that's inevitably going to water them down. Unless you libertarians imagine that we can somehow go door to door, quote, converting people to anarcho-capitalism. And that's just not going to happen.
Well, we can't. You're not going to do it, because it seems so often that the people who are waving the banner of anarcho-capitalism are socially maladjusted, Steve.
Well, there's that.
But
I'm, even if they weren't, right, you're just not going to change people's minds in that way, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to be because of the broad swath of ideas of libertarianism is powerful enough that people are going to start to move in that direction. And I think that some of the polling data and things we look at suggest that people are moving in that direction. Mm-hmm. Marijuana is legal, in states.
Right? Yeah.
Sex marriage is getting there. Right? I mean, these issues, and certainly we've seen outrage about police abuse in some places. So some of these issues are getting there. I mean, that's an interesting case, by the way. A guy like Bradley Balko, who writes about these police abuse issues, writes about a very important, I think, topic for libertarians that comes from himself a strong libertarian perspective. But if you read stuff, there's you don't see the L word in there, right?
He
actually picks up the evidence and makes the case and shows what's happening and puts it out there for people to digest. And I think that's the kind of things we need, more people doing that, translating those ideas, whether it's in the media or wherever, or in art, all these kinds.
Okay, so in this New York Times piece, I think Rand Paul actually did a pretty good job deflecting some of the criticisms, the guilt by association criticisms, because,
I think he's less guilty than his dad, by the way.
Well, here's the thing. He says, you're a conservative Republican or you're a Christian conservative Republican. Does that mean when you think that the earthquake happened in Haiti, that was God's punishment for homosexuality? I mean, come on, that's a really good defense there. I mean, it's not as if Rand Paul has to apologize for what people were writing 20 years ago when he was a kid, right?
Right, right.
So, I mean...
That's right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and one of the things in that piece of mine you read at the start that I wish I'd phrased better, mm-hmm. was when I said it's part of every libertarian's history. I didn't mean that we're responsible for it. What I meant was you can't deny the fact that it's true that libertarianism has been associated with these things. Mm-hmm. If you today call yourself a libertarian, you're going to have to deal with that historical association, right?
Right.
And I think the way you put it, Rand Paul doesn't have to apologize for all that stuff, but he's got to deal with it. Right? it's there, and I thought I agree with you. I think he did a pretty good job. I think deflecting is exactly the right word. And my concern about that New York Times piece is what it does to the broader movement and closer to my heart, the way in which Austrian economics is portrayed in there as part of that whole set of obnoxious ideas.
Yeah, I think our mutual friend Peter Becke was upset by that. He wrote something yesterday on Facebook about how this is why, I'm not sure if he said we need to run away from Rand Paul, but I mean, that certainly upset me because, I'm not a scholar, Steve. I'm a political strategist.
Yep.
And so, to me, Rand Paul represents very much the success of this movement. If it wasn't for that filibuster on the floor of the Senate, we wouldn't have had an extreme turn in public opinion about the use of drones. forums. So there's yeah. I'm a very positive person. I don't like to focus on the negative. And, you know, I feel instinctually like the same sorts of feelings I think that some libertarians do, that they would rather sweep it under the rug. But when I look at what happened in 2008 and 2012, both times when those newsletters surfaced and I saw my political organizations fall apart because of the division of, and the hurt that it caused among so many people that I loved, people of mixed races and, you know, of mixed sexualities, people that I saw that called themselves libertarians that abandoned the ideas, abandoned, you know, political strategies right when it seemed like we were on the verge of winning. I knew then, Steve, that I had to speak up, that I had to do something about it. And just like you said, even though I'm not a racist, and even though I didn't have anything to do with that, yes, it's part of my political history. And so I think that it's very important. You know, if you have a cancer, you have to find it, shine a yep. light on it, and then cut yep. it out before you can go yep. on.
No, that's it. And again, it may be, as some people have said in the conversations, you know, in the blogs and Facebook, that there's nothing we can, that no matter what we do, the quote mainstream media will find a way to attack us. And if so, us being libertarian, if so, okay, so be it. We can't. That's a fixed cost, right? But we can certainly stop making it easier for them to do that. And by the way, I think Pete Betke's point wasn't so much about running away from Rand Paul, because mm-hmm. Pete, like me, in many ways, would like to run for pretty much every politician. I think Pete's point was more that I think it was more about the sort of paleo crowd, right? That he's not Rand Paul specifically for the reason we've been talking about, but the people who sort of polluted Austrian economics this way from the beginning. And, right. and by that, I don't think he was talking about Rand Paul, at least not any more so than anyone else. So
okay,
yeah, but you're right. I mean, I think we have to shine a light on the cockroaches and then, you know, show people where they are and point to them and get rid of them.
Okay, so I want to talk to you about one last thing, and this is going to be, you know, in the realm of political strategy, but we're talking about this. You know, in 2016, it's most likely that we will be faced with Hillary Clinton running for president. Now, the left and the liberals, they tend to hold the moral high ground, at least in their own mind, on issues of things like sexism, right, and gender issues and equality, you know, yep. homosexuality and things like that. Now, if we're faced with, you know, a Rand Paul versus Hillary Clinton, these are going to be the issues that are going to be at the forefront, because I guarantee you that Hillary Clinton is going to run on her whole war on women rhetoric, and it's going to be yep. It's going to be about gender issues. It's going to be about equal opportunity for women. We're going to be doing things like fighting issues like the gender pay gap, which you and I know yep. is a fallacy. So how in the world are we going to be able to take the moral high ground away from someone like Hillary Clinton, who is a devout feminist, when we've got this in our past and we've got to yep. we've got to flip this on its we've got to flip this coin, Steve? How do we do that?
Yep. I think we got to start now, right? I mean, I think we have to start now by doing two things. By pointing it and naming it, happens within our own ranks, and saying that's not okay, all right. And then secondly, we need to keep building up the intellectual arsenal and the sort of rhetorical drumbeat, right? People, like, if Rand Paul is going to make a serious run, he's got to start talking right now in terms of the way that markets deliver the goods for the least well-off among us. He's got to start talking right now about the ways in which various government regulations, you know, harm women. Mm-hmm. Okay, I mean, here's one example. If I were Rand Paul's political, you know, advisor or strategist right now, one of the things I might do is to talk. Everyone's talking about a war on women. Well, if you want to talk about a war on women, think about what Obamacare is doing. And I don't mean to women as I don't mean the birth control stuff and all that. Which there's an interesting question there. 2/3 of new businesses are started by women. Obamacare has made it very, very expensive and challenging to start and grow a new business because of the regulation. This is harming women. But our side's not making that point clearly enough, right?
Right.
You know, so there's all kinds of ways that we can try to grab on, just as you said, to sort of grab onto that moral high ground, or at least knock them off it,
yeah.
right? And say, let's not talk about, you know, the question isn't whether one of us does or doesn't care about women, African Americans, whatever. The question is, what policies will help them? That's an empirical debate over political theory and economics and data and all these kinds of things. Let's have that debate. But we have to watch every word we say, and we have to start pitching our ideas in ways that set that up.
That's excellent. Professor, thank you very much for your time this morning. Thanks for joining us on the show, and I hope you have a great day.
Thank you, Austin. Always a pleasure.
Have a good one.
Yeah, you too. Bye.
Bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening to Freedom Report today. Again, you can find us always at the top of thelibertarianrepublic.com. This is Austin Peterson, and you will always find your home for economic freedom and personal liberty at thelibertarianrepublic.com.